Hi, Queens. I'm so excited today, and you'll find out why. And I'm going to introduce Asha to you by reading their bio. So here I go. Dr. Asha Lamy, he, they, is a trans masculine, weight inclusive GP and a leading expert in weight stigma. They are a fact activist and the founder of the hashtag No Way campaign, which is committed to putting an end to medical weight stigma. They have over 20 years of medical experience and have been fat for even longer than that. Asha, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited. I will try not to get distracted by all of the beauty that I see in front of me. And
Thank you. Just focus.
Focus.
But it doesn't matter if we go on tangents. I do that all the time. So it's as it's meant to be. Before we dive in to the questions that I have for you today, I want to ask you 10 quick fire questions that my listeners find really fun.
Yes. I mean, I'm terrible at this because I talk too much, but I'm going to try really hard. I'm ready.
Okay, let's go. Number one, your favorite food?
Sushi.
Number two, this is probably not an easy one. Your one to three favorite books in the anti-diet space?
Oh, come on.
I know, I'm sorry. That's like the hardest question.
Well, my favorite at the moment is It's Always Been Ours by Jessica Wilson. It's a fantastic book, which really goes to town on diet culture and also on a kind of wellness culture and the wellness world by sort of backing it up with evidence-based practice, but also at the same time, looking at evidence-based practice and how messed up that is as well. And I really love that because the book challenges both in a really kind of helpful way. And it's really funny. It'll just make you laugh. So if you haven't read that yet, got to go and buy it, Jessica Wilson. And then I guess the ones that I think everybody needs to read in order to fully understand fat phobia, one's a heavy one, which is Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings. I don't know who, you know, if your listeners have read that. It's really important because I think it sheds a lot of light into why people hate fat. And then there's a brilliant sort of one that I think if you've read one, you ought to read the other, which is Deshaun Harrison's book, Belly of the Beast. So those are my three picks because I think that they really get us thinking about why diet culture exists, why fat phobia exists. Because I think you have to know it before you can start to challenge it.
So there you go. Absolutely. And I've only read one, the Fearing the Black Body, out of those three. So I'm going to be reading those other two. So thank you.
Oh, amazing. Definitely read Jessica's, but it's just so funny. You'll read it in a day, but you will be, I was quite late at night when I was reading it and I was laughing out loud and my husband thought I'd gone mad. I was just like.
Oh, I'm totally doing that. It's my first pick. Thank you for the recommendation. All right. Number three, the worst diet you've ever been on.
Oh, they're all gross. Worse. I think actually I'm going to say just the kind of bog standard calorie counting one. I did a lot of keto and Atkins, but you know, I hate them all. But the kind of like weighing everything, writing everything in a book, kind of standard NHS calorie control diet is the thing I hate the most.
You know, you probably already know this, but the word diet, if you take the T off, it literally spells die.
No one has ever said that to me before. That's epic. Gosh, literally never thought about that. That is, I mean, there's a book title in here. I mean,
yes.
Wow. Goodness. Yes.
It's cool, right? I think I did see that myself because I'm a word, I like words a lot. And then I was writing it and I was like, oh my God, that spells die without the T. How resonating.
Yeah.
Perfect. You're just going to die inside.
Yeah. A different kind of death. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Number four, something you like that others may consider weird.
It's got to be food. Right, it's got to be food related for me because it's all I think about. So I sometimes like to eat bagels with peanut butter, which I think is quite normal. But then instead of the jam or the jelly that people love, like, you know, peanut butter and jelly, I like to put fresh fruit on it instead. So sometimes bananas, which I think are quite bog standard, but oftentimes strawberries, just fresh strawberries and peanut butter on a bagel. It's delish. You should try it. But you have to have, you can't use the like no salt or sugar added peanut butter. You have to kind of go with the kind of like the one that's got all the additives in, is quite sweet and it's just on point.
I'm going to try that because I love the texture of like sweet, savory, spicy, sweet, hot, cold.
Yes. Kind. Yeah. You have to toast the bagel as well. Yeah. That's my.
Yeah. Who eats bagels that aren't toasted? I'm not down with that.
I mean, unless they are absolutely fresh from the most gorgeous deli ever. But I live in the sticks. I live right next to cows. So there's no fresh bagels.
There's no fresh bagels. Okay. Number five, the best thing about your career.
Oh, getting to help people who have been traumatized, gaslighted, stigmatized in the doctor's office, being able to have to make connections with them and to be the kind of doctor that you're supposed to be. I think that that can be so empowering for people just to hear what they're supposed to have heard rather than all the nonsense that they here all the time. So I love making connections. I like working one-to-one with people. I like doing group coaching, anything where I get to actually work with people and just say, wait, stigma sucks and this is how it should be. I love that.
I love that too. What's the worst thing or the most challenging thing, I suppose is a better word,
of my career or just of that?
About your career, yeah.
I suppose the most challenging part of my career has been accepting the fact that it sucks and that, you know, we collectively, and I absolutely put myself in there, have caused a great amount of harm to a very large proportion of people and continue to do so. And it's so hard, you know. I love medicine. I've wanted to be a doctor since I was really young. And I really enjoy it. I love the, you know, working with people. I like helping people, but it's really hard to do that in a way, in an ethical way. And that has been really hard to reconcile and to decide whether it's something that I'm willing to do. Like, am I prepared to keep working in a job where basically I can't be the kind of doctor that I want to be, need to be, or should be? So that's been the hardest part, kind of same coin, different sides.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Asha. Mm. All right. One about you specifically, what would you say? This is kind of cliche, but I still love people's answers. Go back 10 years. Yeah. What would you say to that 10-year younger you?
Oh, I'd say stop dieting. Don't waste the next 10 years of your life dieting, because I sort of left diet culture when I was 40. So I've been dieting from, you know, childhood until 40, and my goodness, if I could save myself 10 years worth of dieting, that'd be the first thing I'd say. I think the second thing, probably around the same time, would be stop trying to be a woman. You're not one. So around the same time, but actually, if I had to choose, I would say stop dieting first. If I could only tell myself one thing, it would be stop dieting.
Oh, you can tell yourself as many things as you want, because you decide.
Yeah, but then I would say both things. But I mean, as somebody who has divorced diet culture and transitioned around the same period of time in their life, whilst both have been massively important to me and have improved my mental health significantly, if I had to choose which one made more of an impact, actually, that's really hard to do. But I think it is, you know, leaving diet culture and learning to love and accept my body and stop thinking of it as a failure. Because when I did that, all the other positive things happened.
Then you were able to find your true you, but you had to give up that bullshit first.
That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about go forward 10 years? What would you ask your future self?
You know, are we, did we make it? I think, oh God, I really hope that the world improves for the better. I mean, it's a bit of a nightmare at the moment, just everywhere. And God, I hope it's only temporary. So I think if I could ask myself anything, I'd be like, please tell me it got better. Like, because I don't want to live another 10 years like this in this world.
I reckon it gets better.
I think so too. I'm convinced it will. I think that this is a sort of a last ditch attempt at trying to stop progress. And I just think progress is going to happen whether people want to stop it or not. So I'm feeling very positive. I believe that actually the anti-diet movement and the body acceptance movement is also going to make huge gains in the next 10 years. I'm a strong believer in that.
Me too. Super excited about that. Right, we have two left. Number nine, do you have a hobby? And if so, do you mind sharing it with us?
Do I have a hobby? I don't know. I like to do lots of stuff, but I don't know if I'd consider it a hobby. I mean, I've got dogs. I don't know if you consider dogs a hobby, but, you know, they are basically, aside from work and family, they're the things that take up my time the most. So, yeah. My dogs.
Yeah, hobbies. I don't even know why I wrote that. I read like hobby. Who even says that?
I was thinking like, I mean, there's lots of things I like to do, but you know, there's nothing beats spending time with the dogs or taking them out for a walk, or whatever. And they're both rescues, and it's actually been really wonderful to rescue dogs who have had really horrible, like especially one had a really traumatic past. It's helped me to heal a lot of my own trauma actually, just by rescuing a traumatic dog and just seeing how she, you know, how she struggles to trust and how she barks whenever she's scared and watching all of these things. I'm like, oh, she's just like me.
I attack when I'm scared also. Yeah, what I need is like love, not abuse. Yeah. I just need love and understanding.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, last one. I reached out to you and asked if you would be a guest. Why did you say yes? I'm grateful you did say yes, but why did you say yes to coming on?
I don't know that I have ever said no. And I don't want you to think you're not special.
Way to make me feel special, Asha. Thanks.
I was going to say, oh, no. Now I've made it sound like... But just anyone who asks me, do you want to come and talk about, you know, as long as they're interested in talking about diet culture or whatever it is that they want to talk about, or, you know, I always just believe... the more we get this message out there, the better it is. So I don't actually think I've ever turned anyone down, but that's not to say you're not special, because you are.
Thank you. I totally get that. We're all special. And I'm the same as you. If I can talk to a podcast with 5 listeners or 5 million listeners, I don't care, because if one person hears the messages that you know, deliver similar messages, but also the same, then why wouldn't I, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is, I'm a strong believer in making connections. I see how we keep repeating the same old patterns by doing the same old thing. And that is, you know, we allow people at the top to dictate how the rest of us work, right? How we interact with each other and how we work together and, you know, what we do. It's always like starts at the top and goes down. But I believe very strongly that those of us who are down here doing the work of ease, if we start to make connections with each other, things sort of happen as a result, you know, the energy, the universe or whatever, like creates things. And so I am always looking to make new connections with people, get to know new people. And as you say, if there's only 5 people listening, but one person, it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. You know, and like you and I, obviously, we make a connection. To me, that's also really amazing. And so that I also never turn down an opportunity to make friends.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you. I'm grateful for you being here. Yeah. And we're totally vibing. We're totally friends already. So
yeah, totally,
I love that. So let's dive in then. So I'm going to be referring to notes, but honestly, the conversation is going to be what it needs to be. And there's a few things that I want to know personally. But let's start with the broad question of, can we be fat and be healthy? And the reason I'm asking that is because, as you know, obviously, Asha, so many people say, oh, I'm just losing weight to be healthy. Well, that's bullshit. So can you explain how you can be fat and healthy?
So there's a few things. The first thing is that I guarantee you will not be able to define health if I ask you to. You will have your own definition of health. Everybody does. And it's good. It's good to have that definition, but we'll never agree. And there is no satisfactory, complete definition. So when people say healthy, I'm like, what kind of healthy?
Mm.
What are we actually talking about here? Are we talking about physical health in particular? Are we talking about cardiometabolic health in particular? Are we talking about blood pressure, cholesterol, and A1C and this, that, and the other? You know, is it joint pain? What are we talking about? Can we be fat and because healthy is, it's too broad a term. And health, as we try to define it, you know, how we define it, we know it goes beyond the physical, right? Emotional, social, psychological, environmental, financial, all of these things all combine together to impact our well-being. And so that we can acknowledge whether or not we can define health. The question then is, can you be fat and have these things? Physical well-being, mental well-being, psychological well-being, you know, environmental well-being, social well-being. And the answer is yes and no. Potentially you can, but we live in a world that makes that very difficult. And so, you know, once upon a time when people say, oh, I'm losing weight to be healthy, I've always just been like, psh, no, you're not. Because it's, you know, in terms of your physical health, losing weight will do nothing. It will only improve your numbers. And that's what I mean. Their numbers, your blood pressure, your cholesterol, whatever, for about a year, 2 years at a push, and that's it. It will not. There is literally not a single piece of evidence that proves that it will improve your long-term health outcomes. In fact, there is a lot of evidence now that shows that weight cycling fluctuations, especially large fluctuations, a little, you know, small amount fluctuating is normal. We gain weight in pregnancy, then we lose weight. We gain weight as we hit our midlife, then we lose light weight as we get older. Like, these things are normal and they're part of being human. But when you really start fluctuating, when you lose and you gain, and remember, you know, weight loss is not sustainable. It just isn't. There are very few who are able to sustain it, and those that do almost invariably develop an eating disorder as a result. Yeah. So because weight loss is not sustainable, what's going to happen is you'll lose weight and then you'll gain it, and then you'll lose it and then you'll gain it, and you might find that you gain more than you lost, and so you fluctuate more and more and more, and these fluctuations are detrimental to our long-term well-being. There's no question it damages our physical health, increases our risk of diabetes and heart disease and cancer and all sorts of things. So weight loss isn't going to improve your physical health. But when you're thinner, you do get treated better in society. So I understand when people say to me, I want to lose weight for my health. You know, I will say to them, it's not going to improve your rates of heart disease. But actually, I can understand why you think it is going to improve your general health, your emotional health, because people are going to be nice to you, your social well-being, your environmental, your financial well-being. All of those things are caught up in health and are impacted by weight loss because of the fat phobia that exists in this world. And then I say to them, but chances are you're going to regain the weight. And when you regain the weight, everything's going to be that much harder. You know, all of those nice feelings that you had when everyone was really impressed with you because you've lost weight, it's going to be much harder when A, they disappear, and B, they become negative again. Yeah. You'll feel like a failure. You'll feel like, you know, it will impact your self-esteem, your all of these things, your body image, your perception of yourself. You know, it may lead to depression and anxiety and all sorts of things. And also, the more you do this, the more likely you are to develop long-term disordered eating or an eating disorder, you know, whether it's disordered eating or an actual eating disorder, it's going to massively impact you physically and emotionally. So that was a very complicated answer to quite a simple question, but it's not a simple question. It really isn't. And I try to, you know, be balanced about the way that I respond to it, because people want to lose weight, and I hear them, and I don't judge them for that at all.
No, I really appreciate you sharing all of that, because you're so honest with that share, because it is true. And one of the other reasons I love to have you here is because I've recovered in still under the thin umbrella body. So I eat whatever the hell I want in any amounts I want, and I'm free, and I just happen to have this body. And so I don't know what it's like to be afraid, because one of my clients expressed to me the other day, she's going on a plane and she's like so anxious if she's even going to fit in the seat, these types of things. And obviously the weight loss desire is there because of that.
Yeah.
But it does, so long-term weight loss doesn't exist anyway.
Yeah. And so it's a catch 22. And so what we have to recognize is actually we need to be changing society, but that's a push. I understand getting on a plane and worrying about putting on a seatbelt, but I'm not that fat. And so what I always say to people is, look, I'm actually quite a small fat. Okay, I might need a seatbelt extender, but at least I can fit in the seat. And it gets harder and harder the larger you are. And the problem with that is the exclusion, right? We are fat people, especially larger fat people, are excluded from society. So we're excluded from travel and buying clothing, excluded from work. You know, there was a study that that looked at HR professionals and gave them some pictures and asked them which people they thought would be suitable for which jobs. Only 2% of them thought that fat women were suitable for sort of what you call, like, you know, professions, about being an architect or a doctor or anything like that. Only 2%, just by looking at them. And so of course it's going to massively impact employment and popularity and dating and anything that we, you know, all the things we need to not just survive but thrive are impacted by being fat and being excluded from society. So again, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up. It is wonderful when people are able to eat whatever they like, and that's great. But when you're a fat person, that's terrifying, because you know, ultimately you want to be free of diet culture, but at the same time shrink so that you can fit into life easier. And the worst case scenario is you get bigger, which is terrifying, you know, and then I guess makes the whole process of divorcing diet culture so much harder.
I just want to say, like, how I feel towards that. And I'm so sad and angry at the same time that people are treated this way. And so a comment came into my mind that I would like you to speak to. When people say, they see a super fat person and they might say a ridiculous comment like, oh, well, it's their fault. Mm. That literally boils my blood, because they don't know what the fuck they're saying. Can you speak to why it's not the person's fault if they're in a fat body?
Yeah. So there's lots of things that sort of shape our bodies, for want of a better word, and genetics is absolutely the number one. And people are just like, oh yeah, but you know, that's just your DNA. You know, DNA is really important, but it's when we look at genetics, it's not just genes need to be switched on a lot of the time, right?
Yeah.
So you can have a gene that's, say, dormant, and then there are environmental factors which will switch that gene on. And I think it's really important to remember that. There are so many other things that can impact our body shape and our weight. A lot of them are environmental factors. So stress is the big one. Marginalization and oppression, history of trauma, access to healthcare and all of these important things. What we tend to call the social determinants of health, that impacts our genetic code, and it will switch certain genes on. So if you're born into a relatively thin family, then genetically you're more likely to be thin, right? I'm assuming that a lot of your family members, maybe not all of them, because it depends, but probably you come from a relatively slim family and that's just your genetic makeup. But others, myself, for example, we're all a bit fat. None of us are super fat, to be fair, but we're all a bit, there's nobody in my family that's thin unless they married into my family. So that's my genetics, but I am bigger than most of my family members. And that's because I endured a lot of stress, trauma as a child, but also the world around me was very difficult. It's very difficult to access. You know, I was trying to be a doctor and access these kind of upper echelons that I was not welcome in. So that caused a lot of stress, et cetera, et cetera. All of that interfered with my DNA. And then comes dieting. And what we know is dieting switches every single one of those genetic genes on. So the more you diet, the fatter you get. In general, that is the dieting is the biggest risk factor, for want of a better word, for weight gain. So when you see someone in a super fat body, there's a really good chance that A, it was in their DNA, B, that they've probably struggled. Most of them have experienced some, you know, marginalization and oppression, and as they've gotten fatter, it's gotten worse, and so it's a vicious cycle. They may well be on medications that make them fat. There are some antipsychotics that I prescribe sometimes, and when I prescribe them, I look at the patient in the eye and I'm like, look, I'm not gonna lie to you, some people double in weight within a year. That's how incredible the weight loss is on this drug. It's gonna save your life and your mental health, but you're going to gain a bit of weight. So medications, medical conditions, if we're born with insulin resistance, if we're born with, I don't know, certain conditions, or if you know, for our thyroid packs in, that's going to impact it. Also, look, things in life, like I said, giving birth, going through the menopause, getting older, all of these things will impact it as well. But the biggest thing has to be the genes that have probably been turned on by the environment, the chronic stress, and the history of dieting. A super fat person has almost certainly been on countless diets in their life. I would love to meet, if there is such a thing, a person who says, you know, who is in a is a large fat and says, oh no, I've never been on a diet. I'd love to meet them. If you yeah. know of any, please tell them to contact
I've
me.
I've never known of anybody, and I've never met anybody who is binge eating that has never dieted.
Yes. I don't think it's possible.
It's the other side of the coin.
Yeah, exactly. It's the reverse. You know, there's restricting when there's binging, and it's just the same side of the coin. It's also why I get very angry when people talk about restrictive eating disorders and then they talk about binge eating like it's a separate thing.
It's not a separate thing.
Well, what are you doing?
If you are, because I don't want to make this about me, but just so you know about me, I started off with anorexia and then it morphed into binge eating and bulimia. Mm-hmm. So thankfully my body was saying, fuck you, we're not starving anymore. I'm going to binge eat every day to save your life.
Yeah, definitely saved your life. I mean, that's, to be honest, not that we should ever grade eating disorders, but, you know, the fact that you were getting food into you, that will have improved, you know, the amount of energy that's going to your brain, and actually really probably did save your life. So that's a good thing. But I hear you. Binging and I guess bulimia is the kind of the bit in the middle, isn't it? If it's a sort of spectrum, you've kind of got restriction, you've got, well, it's not a spectrum, you've got the reverse side of the coin, and in the middle you've got bulimia, which is literally
trying both. But in the end, mine just turned only to binge eating. And then that's when I got help. And I'm so glad I did.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. And it's lovely. I actually also really like it when people in smaller bodies talk about binge eating, because it's that kind of classic, you know, the stereotype of the thin person with anorexia,
yes,
and probably the average size person with bulimia, and then you've got the fat person with binge eating. And it's really good to hear people in smaller bodies say, actually, but I had binge eating as well, it's not a fat person disease. Because a lot of people will put fat, you know, binge eating and the terrible O word, which I won't even repeat, together, like they're one and the same thing. They've got nothing to do with each other.
Nothing. I mean, just to speak to that, my listeners will know this from hearing me already, but, and again, it's not a comparison of how much you binge, but I would be the person who would eat 10,000 calories in an hour binge. I'm not talking, oh, a family sized bar of chocolate was a binge. I was talking 2 tubs of Ben and Jerry's, like 5 brownies, 1 kilogram of M&Ms, like in an hour.
Yeah.
And so just to speak to that, it has nothing to do with the size of.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I would love to go into now, let's say someone goes to the doctor, the general GP, and I'm going to use a quote when I say overweight, because BMI is bullshit. I'm also overweight according to the BMI. They're overweight or obese in the BMI scale. Bullshit, misunderstood information is an acronym.
Yeah.
And the doctor says, oh, they basically prescribe weight loss to help with high blood sugar and perhaps diabetes.
Yeah.
What would you say to that? Because people go away thinking it's all their fault and they need to lose weight for their health.
So weight loss shouldn't be prescribed for high blood pressure, because there's no evidence that it even remotely reduces your blood pressure, even like in the short term, let alone long term. So if you've got high blood pressure, your GP needs to fix it. You need to make sure that they're actually doing their job, which is to actually figure out what your blood pressure is. Have they got the right size cuff? And are you stressed in that moment? Because if you are, chances are your blood pressure's up. So you want a home reading. You want a, you know, either there's machines you can like wear for 24 hours, a 24-hour BP, or you can do your own readings at home. But anyway, what I'm saying is, make sure you actually have high blood pressure. And if you have high blood pressure, it needs to be treated. And it's one of those conditions that I think, yeah, actually, if you have it, treat it earlier rather than later. You don't want to be walking around with high blood pressure for 10 years. Treat it, even if you're in your 20s or 30s. It's not anything for you to feel ashamed of. It's one of those things. It is genetic. And it's also, there are racial disparities. There's all sorts of disparities. If you have high blood pressure, get it treated. Cholesterol, slightly less. The necessity to treat is less necessary as you're younger. It becomes more necessary as you get older, and you can have a discussion with your GP about that. But again, weight loss is going to do absolutely nothing for your cholesterol. If you want to bring your cholesterol down, take a statin. But as I said, that's not something I would recommend to everybody. That's on an individual basis. Now comes high blood sugar and diabetes, right? Because this is the big thing.
The type two, yeah.
Yeah. So prediabetes, the condition prediabetes, is not an actual thing. It's a made-up misnomer. There was a study done in 2018 that proved absolutely conclusively that just because you have prediabetes does not mean anything. It does not mean you're going to become diabetic. In fact, people can revert back to normal 11 years later, up to 11 years. That's the longest they've had, up to 11 years later. So you've been walking around with prediabetes for 11 years and then revert back to normal without any interference. There is a study that's been going on now for quite a few years where they took prediabetics, put them into three groups. One was basically weight loss, one was metformin, a drug, and one was nothing. And what they found was that over the years, in terms of their progression into diabetes, first of all, it was like 5-6% of people over 6 years progressed. Only 5% of people actually progressed to diabetes over 6 years. But even if you compared the weight loss group and the metformin group, there was like 1% in it. So weight loss, so prediabetes is not a thing. And if you do happen to have a high blood sugar, you don't need to do anything about it. If it's not diabetes, just leave it. Don't panic, don't worry, and certainly don't diet, because dieting is going to lead to weight cycling, and weight cycling, chances are, is going to lead to diabetes. If you are in the type 2 diabetes realm, first of all, if it's happened in the last few years, good chance COVID had something to do with it, because COVID has certainly sped up a lot of diagnoses, and we've had an increase in type 2 diabetes diagnoses in the last
year. Is that due to stress, would you say?
It's not due to food, I can tell you that. People are like, oh, they've been sitting at home in lockdown and eating too much. It's not, that's been disproven, but stress certainly, and it could also have been the virus itself that mm-hmm. interfered with our genetics. Nobody knows yet, but we'll see. But absolutely, this last few years, there, you know, more people and younger people are being diagnosed with type 2. Don't panic. It is not a reflection of you. You did not bring it on yourself. There was nothing you could have done to stop it. And if you had tried to lose weight, chances are all you did was sped it up. So don't panic. It's fine. It's not the end of the world. If it's type 2 diabetes, you've got a couple of years really to even get it under control. You know, trying too much too soon is probably just going to make things worse. Just chill. It's fine. And so, you know, your doctors are going to do what your doctors need to do. And there are plenty of things that are important, and you should absolutely make sure you check your eyes and your feet and all the stuff they make you do. Engage with services. But this is the problem. If you're fat, chances are, like me, you will avoid them like the plague. So I'm 6 months late for my diabetes review, and it's because I can't handle the weight loss discussion. I just can't handle it. And so I'm sitting here saying to you all, make sure you comply with your doctor's advice, whilst at the same time recognizing that it's actually a very harmful, stigmatizing experience. And for some of us, we'd rather take our chances with the diabetes. So what I will tell you is this: weight loss will not, it's categorically proven, that weight loss is not going to improve your diabetes. It just won't. We have two major studies to prove this. One is the DIRECT trial, and one is the DIRECT was the most recent. What's the other one called? It'll come to me in a minute. But those two studies, I mean, that's some pretty decent evidence. I run a webinar on type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, and like weight inclusive treatment for that. So if you are struggling, if you are listening and struggling, just come find my website and I can help.
Yeah, that's amazing. I've actually referred quite a few clients to you, and they paid to have the webinars and things. And one in client in particular was like, oh my god, she had fatty liver, I think it was. Yeah. And she was like, oh my god, I've learned from Asha that actually dieting will increase the fatty liver because it releases X, Y, and Z. And it's just people don't know this shit.
No, they don't. And what's more scary is that A, doctors don't know this shit, and B, they do know it, and they still tell you to lose weight, and that's terrible. But most of the time, actually, because to be fair, I didn't know until I started researching. And also, the guidelines that we practice by say that weight loss is beneficial, even though there is no evidence, even though they acknowledge that there's no evidence to support it. And in fact, in the fatty liver class that I do, I show people the guide, I show the evidence, and I'm like, this is what the evidence says. This is the evidence that the guidelines committee looked at. This is what the guidelines committee said about the evidence. It's all low quality and you can't really make any assumptions. And then this is what the guideline committee's decided to suggest, which is weight loss, which just shows how unethical
they are.
And you've got to ask yourself, if you're that unethical, why? And could it be to do with money? So, you know, we've always got to be very conscious of like people's motivation. So, yeah, come find me if you're struggling with any quote unquote obesity related conditions, because I'll be able to tell you that they're not actually obesity related.
Yes. So what about if a client went into a doctor's office and they had a problem with their knee?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing a doctor would usually say, and I'm using proper client examples that I've had in the past, the doctor will say, if you lose weight, it will help with your knee pain.
Yeah.
How would someone navigate that?
I mean, doctors really genuinely are blow me away sometimes, because they're supposed to be smart. You're like, you're supposed to have like got A's, like, you know, straight A's throughout school, and should be able to use your common sense. But the prevailing sort of myth that extra weight puts pressure on your joints and that makes your arthritis worse is just ridiculous. It's ludicrous, because if you have extra weight, you generally form stronger muscles, right? So what you'll find is people in larger bodies tend to have bigger muscles to support, to carry them. That's why when you go to the gym, you lift weights, right? Like, to build up your muscles. And strong muscles generally tend to stabilize the knee joint. So that's a good thing. If it's talking about pressure or force on the joints, you know, oh, well, you're just putting extra pressure on the joints. If that's the case, then athletes are the ones that are most at risk, because they put the most amount of pressure on their joints. Anyone that's running or basketball, your classic example, if you're jumping up in the air constantly, you're putting way more pressure on your joints than a quote unquote fat person who sits on their bum on, you know, as a couch potato all day. Because you're sitting most of the time. We're sedentary. It's not even putting pressure on our joints. So it's absolute nonsense. What do you do when you're trying to work out? You add weights to your movements.
I mean, that's so obvious. Sorry to interrupt, Asha, but I've never even thought about it like that, because your body's fucking amazing. So duh, of course it's going to build muscle to support who you are.
Yeah. So actually, when we try to lose weight, what do? We lose fat, but we also lose
muscle. Yeah.
We lose muscle.
Especially crash dieting, just eat the muscle first anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So what are we doing? We're harming ourselves. So I absolutely agree that when someone goes to the doctor's office and they've got knee pain, that a doctor might say, I think you need to do some knee muscle strengthening exercises and some stabilizing exercises. I'm a strong believer in those kind of exercises, you know, less about like crushing it at the gym or like running on an exercise bike, you know, exercise to look good. I'm talking about the kind of sort of knee strengthening movements that will actually benefit your knee. 100% do those. And if I were you, I would, if you're fat, I would find someone online or whatever who caters to fat people. So who is going to make adjustments for you, because there will be some things that will be easier than others. And just, you know, if you learn from the experts, the ones who have lived experience of fatness themselves, then you're fine. So movement is great, but weight loss will actually harm you. You'll lose muscle mass, and it's the exact opposite of what you want to do. In terms of arthritis of the joint, so that's actual arthritis. So not all knee pain is caused by arthritis, right? But in arthritis, everyone says it's wear and tear, which is actually not true. the cartilage, our cartilage has an ability to repair itself, and it does for the vast majority of people. But some people, for whatever reason, and part of it is as you get older, and part of it is if you've ever been injured, but part of it is we don't know, and possibly there's a genetic link, it stops repairing itself. And that's got nothing to do with your weight. Like, that's just one of those things. We haven't figured out what it is yet. Stress may play a role in that. You know, environmental factors may play a role in it, sure. And some of those things might be linked to being fat, but it doesn't. Being fat doesn't actually, you know, it's carrying this weight is not causing your knees to get damaged. Problem is, your GP won't know this and will absolutely tell you that it's all because of your weight, and weight loss will help you. So what you need to do is find a way to say, yeah, no, that's not going to work. What else? I run a course about for people who need help advocating for themselves in the doctor's office. I'm not trying to sell it here, but
please do, because it's so helpful what you're sharing, and people need this in their life. So
yes, it's
Nell, do all the plugs that you need and want, because it's supporting people, right?
It's a 6-week course. It's called Take Your Power Back, and it's all about the fact that when we walk into a doctor's office, we have zero power. And I teach people over a period of 6 weeks how to take your power back, how to basically advocate for yourself, which you shouldn't need to do. And as a course in of itself, the course shouldn't really exist, if I'm being honest, because why would you need to do that? But it's definitely a need for people. And so we talk about all of these things, how, you know, if you are that person with a bad knee that walks into the doctor's office and knows even before they've walked in there what's going to happen and is dreading it, and maybe you're even that person that doesn't bother to make the appointment in the first place because you just can't handle it, I can show you how to basically, as much as possible, to get what you want, what you need, you know, in the way that causes the least amount of conflict and is easiest for you. But it's not something I can just tell you in 10 minutes. It's like 6 hours, and we talk a lot about previous trauma, and we talk about communication skills, and we talk about all sorts of things before we even get into the consultation itself, because it's really tricky.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you had that as an offer, because that's what so many people struggle with. And obviously I can share insights just from wisdom, but not past experiences. Yeah. Although I did get weighed last year, and now I don't, I refuse to be weighed. And then she looked at me and she said, well, and this was just, again, her judging me on my body size in a quote positive way, but she looked at me and said, well, your BMI is overweight, but I don't think you've got anything to worry about, simply just by looking at me. And that's actually not okay either.
It's actually really dangerous. I often speak to this, because, you know, we know that BMI is bullshit, we all know this, but the problem is that doctors see thin people, or people who are whatever they want to call them, I mean people who are not fat, I'm going to say, because I don't care what BMI says, and you shouldn't care, you know this, but they'll look at you and go, oh, this person is healthy, but you might not be. One of the things that always makes me so sad is when I hear about an athlete that's had like a sudden cardiac arrest, or has, you know, died at a really young age, and, you know, people are always so shocked. And I'm like, why are people shocked? There is evidence to support this. Why are we not taking this seriously? We should literally, anybody who exercises for more than 6 hours a week should be religiously having their blood pressure checked, should be religiously having their heart monitored, because we know that excessive exercise leads to cardiac remodeling, can lead to sudden cardiac arrest, it leads to high blood pressure. So we know, I mean, the evidence shows this, but the vast majority of doctors ignore it, because they look at the patient and they're like, oh, they're fit and healthy, can't be anything wrong. And it makes me really sad, because these people are actually getting sick really young sometimes, unfortunately. It's very rare that they die, but you know, oftentimes, you know, I've had quite a few patients that have had strokes in their 40s, and they've said to me, I'm a marathon runner. And I've gone, yeah. And I don't say it, but I'm like, that's probably why you had a stroke in your 40s. I hate to say it, but, you know, our bodies aren't necessarily built for this kind of stuff. And if you are going to be exercising that much, you probably need to do so with the right amount of medical support, and you're probably not getting it from your GP, because your GP is completely clueless. And there are so many other reasons why, you know, ignoring your health because you look okay is just as dangerous as implying that somebody who is fat is unhealthy, right? Yes. Either way, it's wrong. It's dangerous.
I have one more question, but just to speak to that, this is a personal thing. I've always been told, because my rest and heart rate is like 39, which is really low. And doctors say, oh, you're just really fit. And that could be the case. But actually, I probably might book a MOT in just to check, because who the fuck knows, right? That's not normal, is it?
Has anyone ever investigated it?
No.
Like, done a KG, right? See, that's my point. 40 is really, I mean, it's I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong here, and probably is your resting heart rate. But if you're fat and you had a heart rate of 40, believe me, someone, why, you would have had an ECG and an echo and a 24-hour tape within seconds. And again, that's actually really unfair to you. So yes, as a doctor, I thoroughly recommend. You have to have at least have an ECG or an EKG, whichever, I don't know what it is in Holland, but whatever they call it. Make sure they assess you properly and that they've ruled out any underlying problem. And then if it's all normal, tattoo my resting heart rate is 40 somewhere on your body so that people know that. Otherwise you're gonna if you sort of, you know, collapse, you get run over. So people are going to be doing terrible things to your body
to try and get me like
trying to like resuscitate you. You should be like,
it's like, it's all right. I naturally am half dead anyway. My blood pressure's low. My heart rate's low. It's all good.
Yeah, no. I used to know an ITU consultant whose spouse was the same, and he literally was just like, I think either made a bracelet or was joking about getting a tattoo because he was just like, if that person pictures up in my ITU, I am going to be doing terrible things to them. So yeah, definitely. But you should have been investigating. Now, that's my point, isn't it? A doctor took a look at you, made a snap decision, looked at you, and went, "Yep, yeah, you look great. Fine, you're fine." Says who? And it works both ways.
Yeah, wow. Okay, last question, Asha. How can we, and when I say we, I mean people who aren't fat, be incredible fat allies? Because the whole world needs to change, and I'm all about being part of that change. How can I and we do that when we're not in a fat body?
I think you already are doing a great job. You are clued up, you're reading, you're learning, and hopefully you're learning from fat people, and you are, asking the questions, which is so important. I think ultimately you just got to follow, you know, the harm comes when people try to make it about themselves. And I think what's happened is a lot of thin people have been stereotyped, like all thin people have been stereotyped as, oh, they're only in it for themselves, which is totally unfair. So I think as long as you're learning from and being led by fat activists, and I'm talking about the good ones, not me, like somebody who ideally is in a much fatter body, ideally somebody who is holds other marginalized identities, is Black or is Indigenous or is LGBTQIA. We need to better, it's getting too long, we need to find a way to shorten that. Someone who's disabled, definitely learn from the disability justice community, because they're absolute experts in this. Like, disability justice is kind of light years ahead of fat activism, I think, and we can learn so much from each other. We're not the same people, but a lot of, we intersect, all of us do, really, anyone who's holding a marginalized identity. So I think if we're learning and being led by these people, you asked me my three favorite books. I gave you three books who were written by people who hold multiple marginalized identities. And whilst Jessica is not fat, she absolutely is a brilliant ally. That's another thing, is learn from other brilliant allies. But I think, you know, the fact that you're doing this and having me here and, you know, wanting to listen and wanting to learn, I think it's great. But learn from the most marginalized people, not from me, from the most marginalized people, and then, you know, follow them, learn from them, see what they're doing, support them. If you can financially support them, because it's really important. Don't forget, fat people are generally poor for lots of reasons. So financially support them and you will be an amazing ally.
Thank you. May I have time for one more question? I think
yeah.
Someone that is listening who is in a fat body and they've heard this episode and they understand and they resonate, what advice would you give to them, knowing that weight loss doesn't work? There's all these feelings, isn't there? A shame and embarrassment and disclusion. Yeah. What would you say to them to help them get where you are, which I'm assuming is, you know, self-love and self-acceptance of who you are?
Not as much as I pretend, you know, like, it's not that easy. There is no easy answer to that. Reach out. Come, you know, as I said, if it's a medical issue, come find me. I'm one of the only, I think, doctors who's kind of active within the fat activism community. Reagan Chastain is the other person who knows way more than me, is not a doctor, but is smarter than a doctor. Greg Dodell is an endocrinologist in the States. There are other doctors out there, but you know, there are very few of us. So if it's a medical issue, just reach out to me, go to my website and send me a message or whatever, and, you know, I will support you. But if we're talking just about in general, One of the things that I did that really helped me was that I filled my life with fatness. I bought fat art. I followed fat people on social media. I started, you know, I used to, I like yoga, for example. So I follow yoga instructors, but only fat ones. And now when I think about yoga poses, I think about fat people doing them. I don't think about thin people doing them. Like, the image has changed in my mind. When I think about kind of like lingerie, right? Not, I don't buy lingerie, but, you know, if I'm thinking about modeling or fashion or anything, I don't think of thin people. I don't follow, you know, Paris fashion show. I don't read Vogue anymore. Like, I, not that I never did, but I, the point I'm trying to make is I filled my life with fatness. Yeah. And so fat became kind of normal. I normalized fatness. And that was the way that I began to kind of accept myself by looking at my body and being like, oh, it looks like everyone else's body. And actually, that's fine. And perhaps that's helpful. I don't know. If I had the answers, I'd probably be selling them. I don't have the answers, so I'm not. But I think that really helped personally help me. Just know also that you are never responsible for your health. And I'm in the process of writing a book.
Amazing.
Yes. I'm gonna self-publish it. I waited for a long time to see whether I could get a book deal. I just really struggled to get one. And I was like, yeah, I'm just gonna publish it myself. Done. I want to put the book out there. I want to put it out there. And so right now, interestingly, I'm writing writing a lot about health, what is health, and then also talking about healthism, which is this, you know, the concept of prioritizing health above all else, health, you know, because the whole point is the chapter before is like, what is health? Oh, we can't define it. And then I'm like, but people still prioritize that, you know, they say we're responsible for our own health, that if you do not prioritize your health, and that, you know, health and fatness become conflated, it's the same thing. They're talking about fatness, not health. But yeah. if you don't prioritize that, if you don't do something about it, that you are a moral failure, you're not a contributing member of society, you know, you're a burden, you were all of these things. And, you know, I am challenging every single one of those beliefs. And I would encourage you to, you know, new listeners to do that too, because it is, you know, it helps everyone, not just fat people, but especially fat people, to know that you're not a burden. And you are not a failure, and you did not bring your medical condition on, and you cannot fix it by losing weight. And you should not be ashamed of yourself. And actually, what is health, and how do we, you know, how do we look at health? How do we prioritize? What is my priority? What, you know, how do I view health? What is my belief system? What do I think is important? Not what other people think. And all of that stuff can be really helpful and enriching, and you know, help you to overcome a lot of the pain that you've experienced in the past. But there's, you know, like I said, I'm 6 months behind in my diabetic review. I avoid my GP like the plague. I am not a role model in any way, shape or form.
Well, you've been an incredible guest, and I've learned a ton from you, and I just love your energy and who you are. So I would say you will be a role model for many, really.
Thank you.
Just sending you all the self-love and acceptance right now. Receive it.
I love it. Thank you.
Good. And thank you, Asha, for your time, for your wisdom. Obviously, I'm going to link everything below. How do you work with people? You mentioned coaching and group coaching. Is that something you do as well as GP work?
Oh, yeah, I do a lot of, I'm doing a lot of kind of, I'm branching out, because I said being a GP is hard, because people are not very nice, and it's very difficult to work in that kind of environment. So I do, as I said, all of those things, they're all on my website. I do masterclasses, which are like an hour off, you know, I've been off because it's the summer, but often I'll pick a subject and talk about it for an hour in a weight inclusive way, and you can join that. I do 6 month group coaching. I see clients one-to-one, all of those things. All you can, if you want to know what I'm doing, just go to fatdoctor.co.uk, and everything's there, including all of my social media channels as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, I will see you next week. Lots of love.